Bon, on va commencer. C'est très bien qu'il y ait déjà tellement de monde. Je ne pensais pas qu'avec la grève des transports, il y aurait tant d'auditeurs au séminaire. On a le grand plaisir aujourd'hui de recevoir David Graeber, qui est professeur à la London School of Economics, et David Wengrow, qui est professeur à University College à Londres. David Graeber est anthropologue et on profite de la conférence qu'il va donner ce soir au Collège de France. J'ai réussi à le kidnapper pour ce séminaire ce matin. Et ils travaillent l'un et l'autre ensemble depuis quelques années sur des questions qui concernent directement la thématique de ce séminaire, à savoir la logique de l'évolution sociale dans des sociétés prémodernes. Et en l'occurrence, ils travaillent depuis pas mal d'années sur la question des sociétés de la côte pacifique, depuis la Californie jusqu'au nord, c'est-à-dire jusqu'à la Colombie-Britannique, et en particulier pour des questions qui concernent des formes de domination, d'inégalité, dans des sociétés qui sont soit des chasseurs-cueilleurs, soit des chasseurs-cueilleurs en transition. Et donc, ils vont nous présenter ce matin dans un dialogue sur le travail qu'ils mènent en commun sur cette question. Ça va être très différent de la conférence que David Graeber va donner ce soir, qui va porter sur les « bullshit jobs », les boulots foireux. Aujourd'hui c'est plus technique, disons, ce matin c'est plus technique, et on est très heureux de vous avoir tous les deux. Thank you for coming. They're going to speak in English and for about an hour, and then we'll have start a general discussion. Merci.
So how do we start?
It could be bullshit jobs among foragers.
I hadn't thought. Yeah.
Alternative title. Do you want me to start?
Yes.
All right.
But I'll take over very soon.
It's with some trepidation that we talk on this topic, because it's a piece of research that we want to talk about, which sort of happened by accident, in that we got drawn into this extraordinary ethnographic and historical and archaeological literature on the foraging peoples of the west coast of North America and Canada, more or less by accident. And neither of us are specialists in any
sense of the term
in California or the Northwest coast, but we just found the whole thing so fascinating, and some of the questions that seem to have never been asked about these groups of people, that we spent a good part of just sort of ploughing our way through the amazing archives, which are now so easily available online, all the work by Kroeber students and so on and so forth.
Yeah, there's a vast, vast literature which is available on archive.org, downloadable and searchable. So we thought to take advantage of it. I should put in a larger context that we've been working on a project for some years, which is essentially rewriting the narrative of the Rousseauian narrative that seems to continually reappear over and over again, no matter how much people try to overcome it. And we thought maybe we can definitively put the stake in the heart of this particular thing by gathering together the results of current research, which largely has not been put before the public. I mean, even the scholarly public. We find that people increasingly not only write for only people within their field, but write only for people within their subfields. Mm. So that when people, even fairly erudite scholars, are forced to fall back on the story of, you know, what happened over the last 40,000 years, they end up telling a story that just clearly isn't true and has almost nothing to do with the picture that would be put together if you took together the evidence. So we've been working on various aspects of this. For example, the fact that hunter-gatherers don't actually normally live in tiny bands. I mean, almost anyone who will automatically assume that for most of human history, humans lived in small bands of hunter-gatherers. In fact, we wrote a piece earlier, specifically as a result of that research, going back to Moses' book, Seasonal Variations of the Eskimo, and the process of seasonality, how people have different social structures during different times of year, would do a lot to explain a lot of the evidence that we have from the Paleolithic, which people are completely puzzled by, because there are signs that look like signs of extreme hierarchy going back 30, 40,000 years, but they're all in isolation and never develop into anything. It makes perfect sense if you imagine there's a seasonal process whereby you create these kind of mock hierarchies in certain types of year and then disassemble them in others. And then we got onto this when we got up to the stage where we were taking on the origins of agriculture. And of course, in the Rousseauian narrative, you have the happy people in the state of nature, and then, of course, the original sin is agriculture. You start demarcating property. Mm-hmm. This eventually leads to the rise of cities, and then you get civilization was assumed to come as a package. You know, you get the cities, you get the state, you get exploitation, war, but you also get writing and high culture. And it's all sort of assumed as a take it or leave it single package. Another thing, which we won't be talking about today, is just how much that narrative is just utterly wrong. Almost all evidence we have show that early cities could have numerous forms of organization, many of which were quite robustly egalitarian. But this particular project came out of trying to understand the origins of agriculture, even though we're talking about people who do not have agriculture.
Well, I mean, the point is that we're not into the business of drawing analogies here between the ethnographic record and the archaeological record. But we are struck, were really struck, when it came to thinking about the origins of agriculture, at just how much the ethnographic record is still being pressed into service as a sort of surrogate or replacement for archaeological evidence, which is how we found ourselves drawn in to this literature, because the peoples, the Aboriginal peoples of the west coast of North America, more than any other, seem to have become emblematic of a kind of evolutionism and a sort of sociological reductionism, which would have them all categorized as roughly the same thing, call it complex hunter-gatherers or storing hunter-gatherers or affluent hunter-gatherers. Whereas in fact, what struck us immediately on reading a bit more deeply into this literature were the contrasts between the two major culture areas as classically defined, as California, which is on your map.
And the Northwest Coast.
And the Northwest Coast, which originally were defined as food areas by Clark Vistler. Food being a crucial sort of vector of differentiation between these two macro areas. And then people have spent many decades unpicking this sort of gross classification. But the area that we became particularly fascinated by is the one at the top of the map on what I suppose is the modern boundary between California and Oregon.
It's in Oregon and Washington.
Which is where these, so this is the map from Kroeber's original handbook. You can see what happens up at the top there. You get this kind of accordion-like compression of ethnic and linguistic groups. It's a sort of shatter zone, which has resisted classification over the years of any sort, really.
You have people with rather similar cultural practices speaking utterly unrelated languages, living in close proximity, and others speaking the same languages with incredibly different cultural practices, cosmological assumptions.
Now, what really set us going on this, I think, if I remember correctly, David, was finding this essay published in, I think, 1951, with a very strange title, and I'm actually going to consult our bibliography. It just shows you what a bad title can do for a great piece of analysis. This is Walter Goldschmidt. Walter Goldschmidt, who worked closely with Kroeber, in 1951, in American Anthropologist, published a piece called Ethics and the Structure of Society, an Ethnological Contribution to the Sociology of Knowledge, which tells
eminently you... Eminently forgettable, yeah.
Eminently forgettable. It tells you almost nothing about what it's about. But it's about California. And
Yes, as a result, no one has read this article.
Nobody's read this article. I mean, it's got remarkably few citations, partly probably because it's also about ethical and moral systems among hunter-gatherers at exactly the time when everybody else was getting interested in ecology and looking more at groups like the Hadza and so on. So it's one of those pieces that's fallen between the posts. But the argument he makes there is quite extraordinary, and it's about California, and particularly these groups like the Yurok and the Wintu and the Maidu and the Tolowa, who are all compressed into that northwestern section of California. It's sort of unfortunate that it's the northwest, because you then have to differentiate it from the northwest coast, which is the macro culture area directly to the north. So we're talking about the...
We'll call it the shatter zone.
The shatter zone. We will call it the shatter zone. And what he points out there, point by point, is that the people living there in the 19th and early 20th century, as documented ethnographically, although they were all foragers, and actually should emphasize that all of the groups we're talking about today did not practice farming. There's a trend these days to write about them as if they were farmers, and to point out that they did a great deal of landscape management and landscape alteration. But at the same time, these are precisely the groups that resisted the tropical crops, maize, beans, and
squash. Perfectly clear they knew about them.
Yeah, which makes it even more extraordinary that they're often held up as exemplars of what human societies might have been like before the origins of farming. In a sense, they're the last people on Earth you should probably look at. So it's a strange sort of evolutionism. Anyway, what Goldschmidt points out, point by point, is that these particular foragers exhibit almost every single aspect of Max Weber's Protestant ethic, in the absence, obviously, of industrialization, wage labor, and the principle of monetary interest. They have money, it's shell money, dentalia. But what Goldschmidt points out is that they also have this moral obligation to work hard and conspicuously be seen to work hard, to make money but not show it off. In other words, don't eat too much and don't show off your wealth.
Just make sure everyone knows you have it.
Make sure everyone knows you have it. And really this sort of principle of abstinence, which is, for example, typified in their sweat house rituals, where in order to enter the sweat house, you have to squirm through this small aperture. So if you're overweight, you can't even get inside to have the sauna. So he points out, it's really a very, very thorough sort of systematic analysis, which, I mean, ought to have had major historical implications. I mean, if you can show that there are foragers who have developed a moral, ethical system extraordinarily similar to that of late medieval, early modern Europe before the explosion of capitalism, you'd have thought that has sort of implications comparatively. Yeah. But it's been completely ignored. And the thing that struck us most about it was that, the other great essay on this region, which was out of keeping with the fashion and the trend towards ecology, was, of course, Lévi-Strauss's discussion, famous discussion of house societies on the Northwest Coast, where he's effectively talking about the neighbors of these Protestant foragers, who, of course, turn out to be rather feudal nobility, who keep hereditary slaves, and as far as anybody can remember, have a long history of raiding one another for people. They're proper capturing societies, as Santos Granero put it in the book he wrote a few years ago.
And, so, and this is very important to emphasize, because this has sort of been written out of the Northwest Coast, that something like, was it 20% of the population appears to have been slaves? So even though you have aristocrats, commoners, and slaves, and aristocrats don't really have any way to boss commoners around to give them orders. But so it's often said, well, you know, they're not really aristocrats except in a very distant sense of the term. But that's completely ignoring the existence of slaves in the pre-colonial period.
That's right. And
who were often killed at potlatches.
Yeah. Yes, and of course the potlatches as an institution, is almost diametrically opposed to the kind of values that Goldschmidt is writing about in relation to this northwestern part of California. So I think we sort of assumed that somebody over the last 100 years must have asked the question, what happened when these people ran into each other? I mean, there's no physical border. These are all reasonably decentralized groups of foragers distributed along the Pacific littoral. There is an archaeological record which shows that you have continuous trade and interaction by canoe up and down the coast going back thousands of years.
The dentelia shells that the Californians are using as money come from the north.
Obsidian and various other things. And yet, remarkably, and we really did read very hard on this topic, nobody seems to have addressed the question of how you end up with two apparently such different societies living on one another's doorstep. The closest we got was that amazing little book by the World Systems guy.
Oh, yes, The Wind to a Very Small World System.
Very Small
Chase
World
Dunn
System.
Chase Dunn and Hall,
from the 1980s, 90s?
Oh, later than that, yeah. It's fairly recent, maybe even 90s.
Fairly recent. And what he points out is that actually the groups here in this part of northwestern California, at least some of them do speak Athabascan languages and were clearly migrants from the northwest coast down into the area of modern-day California, and in the process of moving, seemed to have lost, as he puts it, some of these hierarchical practices and institutions. The argument that we ended up with, and that we will try to, I should say, we've just realized that we've never actually talked to anybody except each other about this particular piece of research. So apologies in advance if it's a little bit all over the place. But the argument we ended up with was that they didn't lose these institutions at all. They quite consciously rejected them.
And this comes, I should probably say, to frame this as an ongoing concern and a theme that's developed in a lot of our research about schismogenetic processes in a sort of Batesonian sense, so that it seems that in many parts of the world you can observe that people are defining themselves against each other. I mean, you could take Jim Scott's stuff on Zomia as a kind of one example of this, but it's a relatively simplistic example. And David had really impressed me, in fact, one of the first ways that his work really kind of blew me away was I was reading an essay he wrote. I'll talk about your essay about metal. Why is it that you find these potlatch-like deposits of metal in the Bronze Age, which are now clearly being thrown away or destroyed in some extravagant way? It seems sort of very much like representations of potlatch or competitive feasting. Something's going on where people are just destroying objects, which are obviously objects of luxury and wealth. And but it always it's never it's at the same time as the rise of commercial and bureaucratic city states. But it's always on the fringes. The guys who are supplying them with raw material, and it would seem that you know there is a process whereby the people in the cities are defining themselves against the barbarians in the hills, but also vice versa. You know, the potlatches and these other or efflorescence of competitive feasting that we often observe ethnographically often happens at the moment when such societies are being incorporated in a larger commercial bureaucratic order, in this case the modern world system, which bent within a generation or two almost invariably eats them up, conquers them, and shuts such things down. But here we have a place where the same thing was happening, but the balance of forces was very, very different. It was about equal. So these people remained in this kind of equilibrium where the people in the cities were being less, tried to be less and less like the barbarians, and the barbarians less and less like the people in the city, sometimes for thousands of years, only for centuries. But the very interesting thing is the people who seem to be throwing away all these vast quantities of metal are precisely the people who later appear in the heroic epics, so whether the Vedas or the Homeric epics. You know, who are defined exactly by this kind of competitive feasting, vast displays, sort of proto-politicians vying with each other to attract followers by great acts of heroism and boasting and dueling and sacrificing. But at the same time, a rejection of writing. You know, that's why you have the epics to begin with. So there is a schismogenic process going on between them. And when you start looking for this stuff, it's everywhere. Our first instinct, something like this is clearly going on. These people seem diametrically opposed. And we return to Mose's idea of civilization as a sort of creative refusal, people simply refusing and rejecting each other's customs as a way of defining themselves.
Right.
Something like that is happening, but how?
We don't have any obvious physical or organized physical resistance in place. In other words, there's no great standing army of foragers, you know, lined up on the border of Aragon saying no more slavery. There's something else going on, and it presumably is happening more from the bottom up. That's right. And then, I mean, where our thinking sort of led us after that, I'm just trying to retrace our steps.
I hope you don't mind that I summarized your article. You can summarize.
No, that's fine. Because you're three different lectures.
It'll work.
So we had these two sort of totemic articles next to each other. We have Levi-Strauss with his sort of nobles on the northwest coast, and we have Goldschmidt with his Protestant foragers next door. And we wanted to try and understand something more about the relationship between these two things.
And so I, for one, scoured the ethnographic record, trying to find some reference somewhere to what people in California thought of people to the north or vice versa. I mean, are there any references? I mean, they were trading. There were objects coming back and forth from between the places. So is there, and I couldn't find very much. I was looking for myths about things like that. But I managed to find one story, which was preserved entirely by accident in a journal in 1870.
I have it here. But before we come on to it, I've remembered now. We went through a long period of frustration and eventually came to the conclusion that we had run into a wall of prejudice about foragers. Prejudice about foragers to the extent that even where you have two such diametrically opposed systems, you know, let's call them, for simplicity's sake, feudalism. It's not feudalism, it doesn't matter. But feudalism and, you know, some form of early capitalism, which it isn't either. But let's just say hypothetically that you had two such clearly diametrically opposed systems next to each other. In any group of societies, nobody would ever dream of lumping them into a single category. I mean, it would be the equivalent of taking the last 1,000 years of European history and just calling all of them complex farmers on the basis that they grew wheat. Nobody would ever dream of doing this, except with foragers.
Where it's okay, they're all the same.
Where, you know, you can take, and, you know, the, I think the most extreme example of this kind of reductionism that I found was the book by Brian Hayden about feasting societies.
Oh, yeah.
Which has Californians and Northwest Coast all lumped in together as a single category. On the basis that they feast, and our feasting foragers, who might have been the kind of people who invented farming, had they not been exactly the kind of people who, in fact, resisted farming. I mean, it's a very convoluted sort of argument. And that's how we sort of got started, I think, was actually, you know, if you look at their feasting, I mean, of course, everybody feasts in some way or another, but if you actually look at their feasting practices, they couldn't be more different, at least as described ethnographically. Now, you know, quick caveat, because we wrote this up and submitted it in a moment of hubris to American anthropologists, which resulted in the most extraordinary review process. I've never had quite such extensive and
detailed
and, sort of, yes, 18
pages.
They sent
pages. It to people who actually knew something about the North West Coast. And,
so
and
we had very detailed response from a behavioral ecologist, and another one from an archaeologist, and another one from a cultural
They're actually mostly positive, except for that.
They all saw some merit in what we're doing, but they were also critical. The funny thing was that the criticisms on grounds of racism, colonialism, stereotyping, and ethnocentrism came largely from the archaeologists, whereas the cultural anthropologist who actually works with descendants of these groups said, yes, at last, you know, somebody's actually writing their history. So all we can conclude from this is that nobody talks to each other in North America, although they're in the same department. But I'm getting off topic. Feasting, right. So, I mean, if you
foragers are all the same in white, yeah.
Foragers are all the same, except they're not. So if you look at the actual descriptions of ceremonial feasting in this part of California, which takes the form of things like deerskin dances and these periodic trade fairs, it's almost like a potlatch in reverse, in the sense that you don't compete with luxury foods. It's mostly about staple foods and sharing them.
Yeah, it's incredibly bland, repetitive acorn stuff.
Lots of acorn porridges and such like. There's none
acorn
of this
soup.
Ranked seating order that you get in the potlatch, where the classifications and ranks are clearly laid out. Actually, what
and
seems
indeed,
to
there
happen,
are no classifications and ranks. Yeah.
No, but even the ones that exist are sort of playfully transgressed in the Californian situation. And you actually get this very generous sharing of treasures and valuables. Things like obsidian blades and important animal skins are actually passed over from one group to another via a dance leader, I think it is. Mm. And they sort of lovingly wrap and look after one another's valuables. Obviously, the contrast here would be with the chopping up and smashing of metal crests and so on, as classically.
And the general aggression of giving away bad things.
So, you know, to describe these all as being the same thing in the way that Hayden's book does seems to do an incredible amount of violence to the data. That's not to say that nobody gained anything by hosting these feasts in the Californian situation. It's clear that there were organizers and big men who benefited monetarily from hosting them, but actually it was Napoleon Chagnon, I think, who pointed out that, you know, they do this. He thought the Californian sort of feasting cycle was really more about buffering and leveling out resources. And California, topographically, is another reason why archaeologists find California so fascinating, is because it resembles, I think, more closely than any other region on Earth, the area around the Jordan Valley and the Fertile Crescent, where farming actually was invented 10,000 years ago, in the sense you have this tight compression of different ecologies.
Micro-regions,
you have the mountains, the foothills, the river valley, the desert, and the coastlines all compressed together in a very tight framework. And yet, in the American situation, it's one of the very last places to adopt farming, which just shows you how pointless environmental determinism is. Yeah. But Chagnon's point was that, quite often these feasts are actually occasions for people from slightly different ecological niches to balance out deficits in the annual harvest and so on and so forth. Anyway, it seemed to us there were some very obvious differences, and that's what set us off looking for differences. And what emboldened us to do this was this little
oral
history.
And it's the strangest thing, because it was written by someone who was looking at these burials and trying, and had a theory that there were Japanese immigrants in this area in some long ago time. The reasons he brought it up are irrelevant. What's interesting is it's the one story about a group that actually went from the Northwest Coast area to the into California and what happened. Well, the story is Chetko.
I've got it right here.
Oh,
you can read it. I know you like reading it.
Really?
It was republished in Stephen Powers' Tribes of California, which
that's
is
it, yes.
1877, based on an account by a geographer called A.W. Chase, which is from 1873.
Right. And he was the guy who was talking about the mountains. So
that's right.
I found it.
That's right. And it's about a group who don't exist anymore, called the Chetko. And this is what he says. So when he was writing this in 1873, the Chetko had been decimated. Actually, this
area, I think that there were like two families left.
Yeah. This part of the Oregon coast apparently was one of the first to fall prey to
basically genocidal attacks by the settlers. Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, they were just massacred, a lot of them.
Yeah, so we're talking about highly traumatized groups who were living on a reservation in Lincoln County when described in this way. But they told this story to Chase, and he says, the Chetkos say that many seasons ago, their ancestors came in canoes from the far north and landed at the river's mouth. They found two tribes in possession of that territory. One, a warlike race resembling themselves. These they soon conquered and exterminated. The other was a diminutive people of an exceedingly mild disposition and white, as in white-skinned.
Which is really relevant, but yeah.
It will become relevant. And they called themselves, or were called by the newcomers, Wogies or Wage. They were skillful in the manufacture of baskets, robes, and canoes, and had many methods of taking game and fish, which were unknown to the invaders. Refusing to fight, the Wogies were made slaves of and kept at work to provide food and shelter and articles of use for the more warlike race, who waxed very fat and lazy. One night, after a great feast, the Wogies packed up and fled and were never more seen again. However, later on, when the first white men appeared, the Chetkos supposed that they were the Wogies, returned.
With even better technology.
Yes, with guns, germs, and steel. But they soon found out their mistake, and yet retained among themselves the appellation for the white men, who are still known as Wogies by all the coastal tribes in the vicinity.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Now.
Yeah, so what's significant about the story is that it directly brings up the sort of value of thinness and fatness. So you have these people from the north, they're very warlike. They immediately show up and take lots of slaves. But the very fact that they do so is their undoing. They become fatter and stupider, and the slaves go on being clever and well-organized until the point where they just run away and they're too fat to chase them. But, it's sort of a simple encoding of a value, which you can see in very much in the opposition between these potlatches, which is all basically celebrations of fat. They're pouring fat on the oil, they're giving each other buckets of fat, they're eating all this fatty fish. Whereas the California thing, where they're just like giving each other this soupy acorn gruel and trying to fit through little holes. And if they're potlatching anything, they're potlatching work. So on the one hand, the Kwakiutl have slaves who are specifically seen as people who get water and drag wood, because no noble person or even commoner would really do that. Whereas in Californians, their initiation rituals essentially involve dragging water and wood for days to build these steam baths.
But you're jumping ahead.
Oh, am I?
Yes.
I didn't go on.
These are the points of schismogenesis that we ended up with.
Yeah, okay.
But I've just remembered that we initially thought how flippant it would be to try and rewrite the whole relationship between these groups on the basis of a single, probably fictitious anecdote from one group.
It doesn't matter whether it happened or not.
Yeah. We ought to consider other possibilities. And the literature which we found out there was written mostly from the perspective of human behavioral ecology.
Okay,
should we talk about this a bit
a
before
little
we
bit.
Get
yeah,
to
I think
the,
we should.
A little
okay.
bit?
Okay. Hold off on the fat stuff.
Particularly because you know, some of the responses, the sort of official responses from the journal to our article were by behavioral ecologists who felt that we were somehow opposed to what they were doing, but it was actually really quite to the contrary.
Front-loaded and back-loaded.
We found one particularly fascinating piece called Why Acorns Before Salmon, which is by Robert Bettinger and Shannon Tushingham. And it sets about this whole... I mean, first of all, it's interesting because it does actually address some of the contrasts that we're talking about between these two regions. But it starts off with the observation that there is an ecological puzzle about California, and particularly northwestern California, which is that, like the northwest coast, this is an area which is very rich in aquatic resources and anadromous fish, so salmon and eulachon and so on, which in terms of traditional behavioral ecology are very desirable foods for foragers. They're so-called high-ranking foods. You catch a whole load of them in season, and you're set up for the winter ceremonials and the rest of the year. And you can store them and process them as oils and fats and all these other consumables.
Smoke them. Yeah.
Whereas acorns and nuts, which for millennia, it turns out, have been the preferred staple in much of California, are traditionally ranked. You know how behavioral ecologists rank things on a purely sort of utilitarian basis in terms of the amount
of
labor.
Pretty low down on the food scale, yeah.
The amount of labor required to exploit a food resource. So acorns are pretty low in the sense
that... Despite the fact there's lots of salmon and other things like that around in California.
That's right.
I mean, they could live like Northwest Coast people had they wanted to.
Yes, and in order to eat acorns regularly, you have to leach them and grind them. It's a labor-intensive thing. Why would any sensible forager put themselves through this misery when they could be... This is the conundrum they start off with. And the explanation they come up with is that it's really all about predation and the risks of raiding, in the sense that, so this is their explanation, not ours, but what they point out is quite a logical point, which is that with fish exploitation, you have an enormous amount of labor that goes into preparing for the first fish run, building weirs, nets, dams, traps, and so on. And then, of course, in order to convert all these fish into storable foods, you need to concentrate an extraordinary amount of labor directly after the fish harvest.
And the labor that you put into it is front-loaded.
It's what they call front-loaded
resources. You have to do it at first, and then you have something that's just good to go.
Yeah.
So you need enormous amounts of work. Helps to have slaves, or some very intense labor force,
whereby you can process the food at first, because it's fish, it's going to go bad. Mm-hmm. But once you've got it smoked and stored and dried or so forth, turned into oil, then it's ready to eat, and it stays that way for a very long period of time. Yeah. Unlike acorns, which are exactly the opposite. I mean, there is the point of the whole thing is that there's not much point in stealing somebody's acorns, because you can gather a lot of acorns. You've still got to do 90% of the work after you steal it.
That's right. So what they argue is that this might explain certain other institutional features of the societies we're talking about, in the sense that societies which rely very heavily on harvesting fish on a seasonal basis are kind of making a noose for their own necks, in that they're creating this great stock of stored processed resources which are very tempting to raiders and thieves, and that somehow this might explain some of the other institutional differences between the Northwest Coast and California. So we thought, you know, this was important to think about, but also not quite satisfactory. If it worked as an explanation, then we can just go home. I mean, it's, you know, there's no point in doing the sort of analysis we're doing, and the tale of the Wogies can be consigned back to nowhere, because you would have a nice, neat, ecological explanation for the kind of social differences. But there are problems with it. I mean, one of the obvious problems is that most of the raiding, which is documented on the Northwest Coast, actually doesn't seem to be for food. It seems to be for people. And the reason people raid for people...
is to process the food.
Is to process the food. But it's not primarily an ecological thing. I mean, there's no shortage of labor as far as we can gather up there. The point is that a great number of the people concerned are aristocrats who wouldn't be seen dead doing most of this work. It's not an actual shortage of hands that you get on this seasonal basis. It's a shortage of controllable labor. And it's rather interesting in that respect that in the parable of the Wogies, it's emphasized that they're very good at this sort of thing. They have efficient techniques of catching fish and making baskets and so on. So what the Chetko or the proto-Chetko are actually capturing is a lot of invested knowledge and skill. So that was one problem we found with the sort of neat ecological explanation. Another thing that occurred to us is that maybe it is a Jim Scott sort of situation, where in the same way that there's no point in stealing acorns, there's not much point in stealing acorn eaters, which is what the Hooper and other groups call themselves.
Yes.
We are the acorn eaters, because what are you going to do with them? I mean, keeping slaves comes at a certain cost.
Right.
And if you can't speak the same language, I mean, you're going to
And they don't know how to do any of the things you want them to do.
Yes. But this is purely hypothetical. Effectively, what this set us off on is looking at that shatter zone in a lot more detail, and actually wondering whether there was some other kind of explanation, which was much more to do with these kind of quite conscious decisions to create another sort of society by groups which had been exposed to but rejected the kind of societies described on the Northwest Coast. And once we started looking, we were quite staggered by the number of examples and instances where you can actually point to what seems like a, more or less a direct inversion in a very Gregory Bateson-like...
schismogenetic fashion.
Schismogenetic sense. I counted them, and I think we came up with seven major points of schismogenesis.
Oh, that's right.
And this is what we will finish on, right? I counted them. So
but we should point out that in this area there is other evidence of interaction. There was a slave trade going on quite early on, where some of the Chinook, the word potlatch is Chinookan jargon. It's a trade comes from a trade language, and Chinookan traders were going around. We only know what was happening the period where horses show up, but the first thing they do is the Chinookans like ally with some people who got horses and start spreading the idea of the potlatch, but also as an idea, a way of mobilizing people to grab slaves to trade up north.
That's right. We found that ethnography by Leslie Speer, which shows very clearly that groups around the Klamath River.
This is in Oregon, way top of
the we're north of the Shatter Zone now. Once they got horses, did actually start slaving and incorporating certain aspects of potlatch. But what's interesting is that it's very clear that this was regarded as an anomaly.
But and that other people were self-consciously resisting it. So these people were interacting with each other. The Wogie story isn't the only example of the two different ethos confronting each other directly. And in fact, some of the ways that people organized war was quite self-consciously to make it impossible for a slave trading society or a slave society to develop.
That was schismogenetic point number one.
Ah, yes.
Which we extracted from Kreber is the legal point.
Yes.
The Yurok actually had legal systems in place which required the winners in a fight to pay individual compensation for every life taken at the going rate for murder. So this obviously makes raiding fiscally pointless and morally bankrupt. And the way Kreber puts it, he says, the vae victis of civilization for the Yurok might well have been replaced, at least in a monetary sense, by the dictum, woe to the victors. So there is a legal system in place against raiding. Then there are the sort of moral points that come through in the anecdote about the Wogies, which, you know, they seem to resonate with Goldschmidt's analysis of these rather Protestant-like features. I mean, the reason that the Wogies come out on top, it's like a cautionary tale. You know, this is what will happen to you if you try and enslave people and profit from their labor. It's the industriousness of the Wogies.
You get fat and you lose your industriousness.
Yeah, they're so fat they can't even chase after them when they run away. And this seems to have been a widely shared tale. And then there were the little details, the sort of schismogenetic details that come through in the description of rituals. So this business about chopping and carrying wood. I mean, there's the magisterial study of slavery on the Northwest coast is by the historian Leland Donald. And he puts together a whole variety of ethnohistorical sources which show that, you know, rather as in with the Gibeonites in the Old Testament, chopping wood
and carriers of water.
No self-respecting Northwest Coast noble would be seen doing these things. So to chop and carry wood was essentially to advertise your status as a slave. And Donald has a variety of sources on this. And then what struck us reading Goldschmidt is that the Californian groups take this particular form of labor and actually turn it into the focus of a ritual. And I'll just read out briefly what Goldschmidt says about initiation rites in that northern part of California, because it's quite striking, I think. All men, particularly the youths, were exhorted to gather wood for use in sweating. This was not exploitation of child labor, so this is all Goldschmidt, but an important religious act freighted with significance. Special wood was brought from the mountain ridges. It was used for an important purification ritual. The gathering itself was a religious act, for it was a means of acquiring luck. It had to be done with a proper psychological attitude of restrained demeanor and constant thinking about the acquisition of riches. The job became a moral end rather than a means to an end, with both religious and economic involvements. And then, of course, as you were saying earlier, the sweating itself is effectively the reverse of the main concern of the potlatch, where you have people consuming blubber and ladling fat over each other.
Or ladling fat over fires and seeing if you can still sit next to it.
That's right. So the joke we came up with was that to enhance his status and impress his ancestors, the nobleman of the Northwest Coast ladled candlefish oil into the fire mm-hmm. at the tournament fields of the potlatch, mm-hmm. the Californian chief burnt calories in the closed seclusion of his sweat lodge. So it seems like another inversion, this time in terms of bodily aesthetics, if you like.
Do we have the real fake thing in there, or should I improvise that?
That's coming next, and that was you. You found that, yeah. So I'm going to hand over to you. Okay. The other thing we noticed is that they seem to have been very aware of these reversals. There's this fabulous article by Brightman about the clown among the Maidu. And what clowns, the figure of the clown, does is kind of laze around and eat too much and behave in a slightly megalomaniacal fashion, almost as if dramatizing this kind of other...
Not even almost as if.
Exactly as if. And then you found out this point about fraud and illusion, right?
Is that in there?
That's this bit.
Which, where is it?
Over the top.
Oh, yeah. If you look at ritual, it's really striking that there's this obsession of interiority in California and exteriority in the Northwest Coast. Of course, the Northwest Coast is most famous for having these masks and transformation masks within masks and sort of theatricality. They're really into sort of props and stage effects and trapdoors and fake blood and, you know, all this theatrical illusions. And in fact, the word for ritual is illusion. I mean, it's the same word. There's been a lot of debate about this, but it could mean fraud or fake. You know. But there's a kind of a play, a constant idea that the sacred involves a play of surfaces and false surfaces, and you're attaching on names in the same way as you attach on masks. Whereas in California, you know, so the word for rituals is fraud. Whereas in California, it's all about reality. You know, it's all about finding the real reality, which discovering that the real world is an illusion. And it's through these exercises of carrying wood and water, steaming away yourself, so forth and so on, that you and doing these various mental exercises and forms of meditation. So it's very Protestant, and it's a way of mystical Protestant almost. Finding the real world.
Is it an ontological difference? Almost. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yes, let us discuss this. So it's reflected very much on an assumption about what you're basically doing when you engage in ritual. One is really you are finding this interior self, of the true reality of a world which is not normally apparent to you, whereas in Kwakiutl it's an endless play of surfaces.
Yes. So, and the Californian, the point of ritual in the Californian case seems to be about finding what is authentic within oneself. And there's a very striking account. I mean, obviously, both of these groups from time to time adopted Europeans. And the Europeans in the Northwest Coast case were often given honorific titles and so on. But a European who was unlucky enough to be adopted into a Californian society would find himself hauling wood down the slopes, crying. I mean, the act of weeping to show how hard you're working and how painful the
weeping
work is.
Weeping or sweating or sweating off water seems very important. And then they become one of the real people.
You become a real person. Yeah. Now... And then you found this account by Buckley, who is... So this is a recent ethnography.
One of the very, very few.
That's right. Which is interesting. I mean, if you hold in your mind the kind of idea of Northwest Coast ritual as a kind of game of smoke and mirrors, masking, illusion, and so on.
And the California, nowhere in California do they ever use masks.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. Why didn't we say that?
I don't know. Why didn't we?
I don't know. It's such an obvious point. It's too late.
All right. Write that down.
But if you hold that in mind about the Northwest Coast, and then you listen to this guy, Buckley, and he's talking here about somebody called Spot, Captain Spot.
Captain Spot, yes.
in 1865, so this is one of these Europeans who was taken
in. Was he Iraq, or he was European and became Iraq?
Yeah. He became Iraq. As he accumulates himself and becomes more clean, the person in training to be a proper person with his Iraq relatives and peers sees himself as more and more real, and thus the world as more and more beautiful. A real place in experience rather than just a setting for a story for intellectual knowledge. And then Buckley says, in 1865, Captain Spot trained for many weeks as he helped the medicine man prepare for the first salmon ceremony at the mouth of the Klamath River. The old medicine man sent him to bring down Sweathouse Wood. On the way, he cried with nearly every step because now he was seeing with his own eyes how it was done. Tears, crying are of crucial importance in Yurok spiritual training as manifestations of personal yearning, sincerity, humility, and openness. You discover your true vocation in a very Weberian Protestant sense.
He's about as opposite to a Quaker chief as you can possibly imagine.
And in fact, he then goes on to say, when someone else's purpose in life is to interfere with you, and this is what Buckley's informants told him, he must be stopped, lest you become his slave, his pet. He thought, okay, that's about as clear as you could hope for. And maybe that's where we should finish, having more or less convinced ourselves and just about convinced three regional experts that there
that
is something
is going on here.
Yeah. And obviously, you know, it's going to take decades more research. This is just really opening up questions. We don't claim by any means to have reconstructed exactly what went on here. But, you know, as the archaeological evidence accumulates and you can begin to put it together with some of these ethnographic and historical sources, it seems at the very least to be a worthwhile question you know, at what point does this divergence occur? Are we talking about millennia? Are we talking about centuries? And then, I guess underneath that, the point that we ended up with is that the sheer diversity, I mean, the political dynamism and diversity of foraging societies has been so horribly underrated in general.
Yeah, people really do see foragers as slaves to their environment to some degree. Or if they're not, they're just assumed to have some sort of default egalitarian simplicity. It might be environmental factors might complicate it somewhat. Yeah. But they're not seen as people who engage in politics in any meaningful sense of the term. And I think this is one of the key things we were trying to bring back, is that these are people conscious of different political, sociological, organizational possibilities, in the same way that people were moving back and forth seasonally in many places between alternative social structures. So they were aware of social possibilities and developing a set of values that rejected some and accepted others, often in contrast with their neighbors, in a mutual process of schismogenesis. And this is how politics has worked through much of human history. And it doesn't start with agriculture and the rise of cities, so people have always been like that.
That's right. So in the end of this adventure, we learned almost nothing about the origins of farming, but we learned something about...
We have theories about that too.
We have other theories about that. But we learned something about the political possibilities without farming, if you like.
We felt it was, you know, even though we didn't come up with something useful for original premise, it just seemed so important to point out that.
Yeah, especially
why
since.
Why has no one talked about this?
Well, especially since, these same groups are sometimes even described as being, incipiently hierarchical or having sort of emergent hierarchies. I mean, presumably, if you're a hereditary slave, there's nothing incipient about this.
Yes. But if other people have, self-consciously formed an anti-slavery ideology, which is what seems to have happened here, that's very historically interesting. And the fact that no one's ever even pointed it out or considered something worth discussing is itself, rather startling.
And that's all we wanted to say, really, isn't it? And in the end, I think.
Okay, let's leave it at that.
Thank you for this very lively dialogue. Obviously, we are witnessing something in the making.
Yes. for a volume book for, someday.
Yes. Meanwhile, until we have the a text or a larger article or a volume, we'll start asking a few questions. I think the schismogenesis argument is very cogent and suggestive. But I was, I mean, it implies stability in a way. The more you differentiate yourself from the neighbor, the more you tend to fix and reify perhaps some features by contrast. And so there's very little room for changes in different, either in technology or in ethos or whatever. Change may happen when people try to combine things. And in fact, there's a very interesting little group, the one which is up north, the Tolowa. I remember reading 40 years ago an article by Cora, how you say in English? Dubois in French, but Dubois, no, is it?
Dubois. Cora the American.
Cora Dubois?
Yes, Cora Dubois, you say?
Yes.
Of the Tolowa Tututni.
That's right.
Yes, okay. And it's a very interesting article because it's. It's a very clear example that there are different spheres of circulation which do not connect, which has been, it's a point that was made. She I think she wrote this article before the war in the 30s. And so there are prestige goods that circulate in one circuit, and then there are other kinds of goods. And these people had slaves. And what is interesting in that sense is that slaves were young people who behaved, well, they were behaving like young people, that is, misbehaving, and so they would be fined.
Yes.
And so, since they had no prestige goods, these fines were paid by people who had these goods. And so if they could not repay these fines, they would become slaves. Mm-hmm. And so here you have a combination of something which is very close to Protestant ethics, in the sense that the accumulation of prestige goods was important, but without raiding, without conflict, and at the same time, slaves, in fact, were the byproduct of ill conduct, in a way. And it seems to me like some kind of combination between the two ethos, the one from the north and the one from the south.
Absolutely, yes. There are several societies in that shattered zone area where they do that. And the Yurok do that too, as a matter of fact. They have debt slaves. In certain ways, there are points where two systems actually overlap, whereby there is where the payment of fines for murder makes it difficult to win a war, but they also have an alternative arrangement where you can profit off it. So the two, they shift into each other and overlap, and in that really complex area up there is precisely where that's happening.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah.
And wouldn't you say that precisely these people who try to combine different features are in fact the movers? I mean, the one who tend to invent new forms of or new solutions to ethical, political, social problems, and in fact are the transformers by contrast with people who stay. In a face-to-face schismogenesis?
That's a good question. I mean, the very fact that the Wogi story does come from that area shows that these things were being contested in a way that they didn't have to be contested in other parts of California.
That's right. And actually, I mean, I think when we got to about the third draft of the written version of this, we just had to keep reinforcing that we are not talking about the total Californian culture area as classically conceived. It is specifically about these groups like the Tolowa and the Yurok, who are in that interstitial situation.
It's a kind of zone.
As you say, it does seem to be incredibly creative.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I've noticed about the zones of creativity, this happens in the literature that we have. It's there are these kind of, it's particularly in these zones of sort of chaotic transformation that also between settlers and indigenous people, that a lot of political creativity takes place. There's a whole debate, for example, about the origins of the American Constitution, to what degree did this Six Nations of the Haudenosaunee actually, you know, it's called the influence debate, you know, influence the Constitution. It's very interesting because both ethnographers of the Haudenosaunee and, at least white ones, and historians of the Constitution hate this idea, actual indigenous people and also the American Congress think it's fine. One of the things that nobody seems to remark on is the fact that most of these debates and arguments between and the sort of creation of the Haudenosaunee Constitution and the relation with settlers took place in a zone where people were completely overlapping because half, you know, missionaries complained they couldn't preach in Seneca because half the people didn't know Seneca because they'd all been taken from other societies. And I looked into it, and half of the negotiators who first proposed the idea of forming, you know, they said, well, we have a federation, you guys should really do it too, to the colonists. One of them was actually named Chicolamy. He was actually French. He was like, you know, taken in war when he was 12 and when Seneca became a Seneca statesman. So it's exactly in these zones where everybody's completely mixed up that this kind of political institution building really comes out of. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You have a clear case of schismogenesis up north, in the contrast between the Northwest Coast people and the people of the interior, precisely. Mm-hmm. The Dene also.
Right.
With exchanges also. La geste d'Asdival is in fact an interpretation in mythology of this contrast of schismogenesis.
Ah, we need to look at that.
Perhaps no.
I hadn't thought of that.
You could read that as a process of schismogenesis. No, that is the inversion that that Lévi-Strauss points out in the myth,
the land, yeah.
from the coast and which are the I think the Bellacula, if I remember correctly. Okay. And the Dene on the other side of the mountain, in fact, is an actual and deliberate act of schismogenesis, in myth at least.
Huh. It's one of the clams and the mountain goat horns.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
That's a very good idea. We'll have to look into that. Yeah, and there's mini schismogenesis happening on all sorts of different levels and shifting around.
Yeah.
You know, there's the larger one, but like in that zone, there's probably five different types of schismogenesis going on in all sorts of creative ways.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I guess that this would apply to the ecology as well, in the sense that all of these groups are familiar with farmers and farming populations, whether it's in the Great Basin or the American Southwest. What is going on those frontiers? Yeah. That's another book.
I was wondering also the question that you your discussion of the behavioral ecologist argument about the control of the result of processing fish and what could be made of it, and the necessity of having some kind of military armed force in order to protect this. It rings a bell here because you're probably familiar with Alain Testard's argument on the, in fact, the origin of inequality as being based not so much on the shift to agriculture, but in fact, the stockpiling or accumulation, whether it's obtained through agriculture or through foraging, and so I think the control of the stock becomes a central point, precisely not necessarily interpreted in terms of very immediate ecological analysis, but becomes a central point to understand this, perhaps the emergence of certain kind of control, social control, and the necessity to protect the stock, etc.
I can see that, but at the same time, I find it very hard to envisage how a situation of endemic raiding between relatively small-scale foraging groups could ever have produced a farming economy, because you never have the kind of stability that would lead to, you know, an incremental return on investments, which is implied by agriculture. So I think the point Testal makes that really interested me was actually about, well, it's another sort of schismogenetic possibility, which is something we're working on. Testal made a fascinating observation in the 80s, which seems to have been completely ignored in the Anglophone literature. And he seems to have worked quite a lot with archaeologists and was certainly familiar with the evidence for head taking and head focused rituals and skull portraits and such like in the early Neolithic societies of the Middle East in the Fertile Crescent. And he pointed out that, you know, these you're familiar with these from Jericho and Çatalhöyük and so on, these heads which have been plastered and painted and so on. And he said, well, surely, you know, this must have something to do with taking heads and violence in some way. Which is probably not the case, but it's simply not something that archaeologists and prehistorians had really thought about very much.
You can tell if somebody's head has been cut off.
You can tell, and actually what might be interesting to look at is whether the evidence for that kind of violence is present among contemporary foraging societies, which increasingly I think might be the case. So that once again, you could have rituals which are really about the care of the head, juxtaposed to something which is
Göbekli Tepe style head chopping behavior.
It's just a theory that we're sort of playing with at the moment.
We should mention that the one of the theories of the origins of agriculture that we did come up with, and it's a little bit silly to come up with a theory of the origins of agriculture because agriculture has so many different origins and has been, you know, since it really isn't a discovery, foragers know perfectly well how plants grow, so you can't tell one story, but the story that seems to be most cogent in the Near East is, it seems that it was, you know, it's almost the reverse of the Rousseauian story. Rather than agriculture leading to social differentiation, private property, class structures, you have something like a stratified society already emerging with Mesolithic foragers, particularly fisher folk, and the people in Göbekli Tepe also seem to be these kind of predatory raiding societies. And it's quite possible that the agriculturalists are just sort of running away from that sort of thing into marginal territories and making do with new techniques to be able to do so. And on the first agricultural side, seem distinctly more egalitarian, especially the role of women, which is very, very prominent. They seem much gender egalitarian. One of the most cogent signs of this that you can actually see is their attitude toward heads, as you were about to say.
This is work in progress.
Yes, this is work in progress, but why not? Yeah. It just seemed like there's a lot of severed heads and human sacrifice going on in the Göbekli Tepe, these giant monuments created by foragers. And Çatalhöyük, around the same time, they're carefully nurturing the heads of their ancestors.
But what Testal seems to have done is make the prehistorians confront this increasingly compelling evidence for extremely violent raiding and slaveholding way back into prehistory, with examples mainly from Europe, where the evidence is...
Is it all Mesolithic, or does it go back further?
Well, I mean, it goes back as far as you want to look, but the scale of it in later prehistory in Europe is really quite striking. Mm. Mass burials, particularly in Germany. I think there's a lot of thinking to be done about generally the role of slavery, which was something not much talked about because it seemed too hypothetical. But the evidence now is so compelling in terms of body mutilation, mass burials, and evidence of warfare.
Evidence of warfare, where, for example, all the males seem to be killed and all the women vanish.
Yes, you have Neolithic mass burials in Europe where the young women are missing, and you have isotopic chemical studies on human remains that show the movement of women from inland to coastal areas. Now, you could interpret that in any number of ways, but I think the point is that the archaeological science is actually getting good enough and detailed enough now that you can at least begin hypothesizing about these kind of processes in a way that just wasn't possible before. Except by analogy with ethnographic cases. I think Testar was onto that.
Mm. Mm. Yes, I think so, especially also in his last books, because he's left numerous notes, and in fact, there's already been two posthumous books published. One
really?
Very recently,
and almost nothing of his work has been translated.
No,
into English.
No, no, no. It's a shame.
It's terrible.
The article about the origin of inequality stocking food. Mm. Has been published in English, but it's one of very few pieces that have been translated into English. Mm. I'm sure there are questions. I have many questions also, but still.